Hey, welcome along. It is 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in the great state of New Hampshire. That means it is 5 p.m. in the Canadian Maritimes, 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 10 o'clock in Western Europe, midnight in Moscow, half past midnight in Tehran. Big shout out to all you far-breathing Ayatollahs digging the show. And it is 2:45 a.m. in Kathmandu, where they have quarter-hour time zones for all you Gurkhas, loyal soldiers of the Queen, listening in Kathmandu. I hope we have more Gurkhas listening than fire-breathing Ayatollahs. Wherever you are around the planet, welcome to the first of our Clubland Q&As for 2019. It's January, brand new year. I should mention that next month, the great Dennis Miller and I will be kicking off our tour. I think it opens in Reading, Pennsylvania. And then we got a couple of New York gigs, Syracuse, New York, and Rochester, New York. And Syracuse isn't that inconvenient if you're... I'd like to see a few Canadians in the crowd, because I know Dr. Roy is coming from Montreal, and I always do my Marquess of Dufferin Vice Regal gags for him. Then that's not really big with a Pennsylvania and New York crowd. The Marquess of Dufferin gags don't usually go over so well. So I hope we get a few Canadians in the audience. And if you're in the Thousand Islands region, Syracuse isn't too bad and not too inconvenient. And if you're almost anywhere along the QEW, Toronto, Hamilton, St. Catharines, wherever, come and see us in Rochester. And then we have this... the one that's proving a tough sell, mainly because neither Dennis nor I know how to pronounce the name of the joint. Wilkes-Barre, 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 whatever it is. I'm staying in Wilkes, and Dennis can handle the Barre. It's like the Twin Cities, like Budapest, Minneapolis, St. Paul, I don't know. Anyway, we're going to be there, and that's a little that's a sluggish one at the moment because we keep insulting the natives by mispronouncing the name of the town. So if you're anywhere within a convenient 1,500-mile drive of Wilkes-Barre, 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 whatever the hell it is, do come, because I can't get it nailed down, an answer on that. This is our first Clubland Q&A of 2019. We're starting a little late because we should have been here 2 weeks ago, but I was being deposed as part of the ongoing litigation by the college loan cockwomble, Carrie Katz. The world's number one college loan cockwomble, I believe. Carrie Katz, he's suing me for calling him a cockwomble. That's why I make a point of always calling him a cockwomble there. And whatever, he used to be with CRTV, but they've merged with Glenn Beck or something now. So I don't even know the name of the corporate entity that's suing me. But we weren't here 2 weeks ago. It does affect... I mean, I joke about it and everything, and I couldn't care less about it at this point. But it does take up real time, and we might have to combine performance and litigation. One of their twerp lawyers just sent some stupid idiot delaying tactic about 20 minutes ago. I don't know, I'm doing this, I don't have time to respond to his idiotic delaying tactic. So I might actually have to do it live on air. We might have to combine. I think we're going to have to, in the interest of efficiency, we're going to have to combine litigation and performance. That's just a heads up to you that if I suddenly start doing, wherefore now come the defendants before this honourable court, it's not that I've lost my marbles. It's just, you know, big shout out to the judge. We got to like combine things here. I wanted to pick up. We'll have a little bit of content before the litigation stuff gets in. I wanted to talk about the subject that just erupted out of nowhere. It's a small thing. But I wanted our starting point to be the bigger picture, what I call what Tucker likes to call the 30,000-foot view of the thing. And that's where I started when I was on with Tucker on the telly last night. I said that when I was a kid, I'd always been kind of bored. I wasn't a sci-fi guy. Some kids are and some aren't. And I wasn't a sci-fi guy. Because I can never get into the sort of futuristic dystopia where the dehumanized individuals are mere chattels of an unseen, all-powerful machine policed by these sort of drone commissars. In a society where technology has advanced, but liberty has retreated. Because to me, the more interesting thing is not what happens in that world, but how you get from our world to that world. And I said as a kind of throwaway thought to Tucker, I think we're actually living through that connective moment right now, the getting there from here phase, where technology is advancing, but liberty is retreating, and sometimes in horrible ways, absolutely horrible ways. Even if you take, and we were discussing it in the context of what happened at the Lincoln Memorial on Friday, at the tail end of the March for Life, the protests against abortion, which never gets covered in the mainstream media. But they found a way to cover it this time. They needed something. At this stage, there are no media. There is no journalism. And generally speaking, you're best to believe everything is a lie. It's as if there's a man constructing an official narrative somewhere in a basement somewhere, and everybody else gets the facts and reads it out on air and sticks to the script. And the script had a little bit of a wrinkle on Friday, because Robert Mueller came and at 7 o'clock in the evening, and he came and 86'd the theory that Trump had engaged in obstruction of justice with Michael Cohen, his lawyer. I apologize to all you fire-breathing Ayatollahs listening in Tehran and you retired Gurkhas listening in Kathmandu for a little bit of internal Washington stuff here. But basically, we're in now, whatever we are, the 12th year of the Russia investigation. It's going nowhere. But they all got excited on Friday because they thought they had the goods on Trump on obstruction of justice. And then at 7 o'clock, Robert Mueller comes out and says, no, that we're 86ing that. That didn't happen. So the story dies, and they want something. Instead of having to spend the weekend covering why they all got ahead of their skis on this nonsense story from BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed, is that what it's called? And I like the way, by the way, I can't get over, this is fascinating to me too, I can't get over how quickly respectable media have died. So the point now where stories are generated from BuzzFeed and then the New York Times and the Washington Post, their principal function in life is to discuss what's happened on BuzzFeed or Twitter. They don't actually seem to have much other purpose. So they needed something to distract from that, and they came up with this these kids from some Catholic school in Kentucky who got into a bit of a showdown, supposedly, with a Native American elder. And, I mean, you know, who was drumming? By the way, if you do come across a Native American elder drumming at the Lincoln Memorial, and you're wondering what particular tribe hangs out at the Lincoln Memorial, what reservation is it a part of? Well, he's not. He's basically not. If you come across a Native American elder drumming, I'm happy to go for that if you're on some wild bit of Abenaki. Actually, up near Natashquan on the Lower North Shore, if you stray from the Natashquan part of the town to whatever the Montagnier Reservation is, and you happen to come across a Native American elder drumming, good for you. He's probably the genuine article. But when you come across a Native American elder drumming at the Lincoln Memorial, he's some kind of activist. Anyway, be that as it may, what was interesting to me about this was the way, and as I wrote about yesterday and as I discussed with Tucker, was the way the right fell for it. They accepted the left's framing of the story. And that staggered me, and I thought it was wicked. And my contempt for the guys who did that is even fiercer today because of their mealy mouth, including this guy Frankovich. I've never heard of this guy Frankovich. He's the deputy assistant, associate assistant, deputy associate assistant, managing editor, National Review. Wasn't there when I was at National Review. But his mealy-mouthed apology, given that basically, he joined in taking the tire iron to a guy. This teenager is living with death threats because people don't like his facial expression. So it's okay to kill people now for their facial expressions. And this guy at National Review, this creep Frankovich or whatever he's called for, can't even do a full-throated apology. I did see one. I think it's from a lady at the New York Times who actually did do a full-throated apology, an appropriate apology. And we should probably, let me find out, see if I can get her, pull up her name. Because actually I did think she did the decent thing. And actually did do a, I'm going to find this, bear with me, I type at the speed of whatever now. Here, what's her, she was a lady at the New York Times, and her apology was actually a proper apology, and the twits at National Review could actually learn from the way this lady just actually did the real deal, a real proper apology. Where are we going now? I'll find it. Talk about yourselves. If you're the fire-breathing Ayatollahs and you're thinking the show should be, I'm going to find it. It's coming. It's here somewhere. Let me see where I can find it. If you're the Gurkha, don't worry. The show will get a lot more interesting. If you're one of the fire-breathing Ayatollahs, just bear with us. I'm going to find this. It's going to where is it? I can't find it. That's incredible. I want to find this. At any rate, it was a full, proper apology. And we have not had that from National Review. Got it wrong. They gave grace. Here it is. Kara Swisher from the New York Times. She said, I was a complete dolt to put up this and several other obnoxious tweets yesterday without waiting to see the whole video of the incident. And I apologize to the kids from Kentucky unilaterally and also for using that clip to make another point about, of all things, a razor ad. She says I was a complete dolt. Where are the complete dolts at National Review about coming clean like that? Where are they? You know, and I'll tell you why this is personal to me since we brought it up now. I haven't said a lot about why I left National Review, but if you recall the things, I quoted a couple in the context of the Phil Robertson business, where he couldn't quite see the appeal of homosexuality. And in the course of that piece, I quoted an old Dean Martin gag and an old Bob Hope gag. And this guy, Jason Lee Storts, I was bemoaning the way a guy can make a joke and get his show cancelled. Or not a joke. He just made a sincere remark and got his show cancelled. I don't actually want to live in that world. I think that's an evil world. Jason Lee Storts, the managing editor of National Review, this guy Frankovich's direct superior, he got all rather sniffy about that. And he said, obviously, he supported me on the principle of free speech, and he would be there in the trenches with me on free speech. And I responded to him. I said, I don't actually think you guys would be in the trenches, because you don't really need people. You don't really need people hanging back who are saying, and I thought of this again during all the statuary thing, when they were taking down the Robert E. Lee thing. Stuff. They were taking down statues of Democrats, which is fair enough. And Rich Lowry, the editor of National Review, appeared on TV and said, oh, don't worry about it. When they start taking down the statues of Washington and Jefferson, we will be there to protest it. Well, you know, funnily enough, actually, shortly after that, they began talking about taking down statues of President McKinley in California. Took a bullet for his country. Took a bullet for his country. Just the other day, they covered up murals of Christopher Columbus. So we're not talking about Civil War guys. We're not talking about Confederate guys. They took down a statue of Stephen Foster, whose songs were beloved in a country torn apart by Civil War, whose songs were beloved by both sides on the Civil War. And yet, oddly enough, Rich Lowry's full-throated defense of all non-Confederate statue, he seems to have fallen silent. So I do have a problem with the faint-heartedness of the right at a time when the left is serious about setting the clock to year zero, which is what we're talking about. It's so long since I've done one of these. My intro's gone on a bit too longer. So let us get that said. Let us get to your questions, and as soon as I can find them, because I'm a little bit rusty with all the equipment around here. Oh, tons of questions coming in. I shouldn't have been yakking on like that. I was just killing time. And now I've got 1,000 questions to answer. Okay, let's see what we got here. Let's see. Fran Lavery says, it's hard to remember the days when pundits got it right at first. There must be echelons of cocktail parties to imagine living, if you can call it that, in the desperate swamp and having to spend years trying to crawl out of those backyard toxic masculine barbecues. And you finally reach nirvana inside a Bethesda, Potomac or McLean mansion. That's McLean, Virginia, if you're one of those fire-breathing imams listening in Tehran. McLean, Virginia mansion with butlers, limos, caterers, liquor pouring nonstop. It must be like hopping a heroin addict's bullet train, reaching swamp society state. Reality must just, well, you know, everyone goes on about this. Cocktail parties. The right are faint-hearted because they don't want to be ostracized at cocktail parties. I don't actually think there were that many cocktail parties in Washington. It's a rather abstemious town that goes to bed early, in my limited experience of it. But I do think they don't actually see the reality of America, which is the most, if they actually go to the places that don't, because we've divided. If you're the wealthiest counties are the ones nearest government, whether it's national government in Washington or whether it's big state government like in Sacramento, California. The wealthiest counties are the ones that are nearest big government. And then you go outside that safe space, and it is a safe space, to the parts of America that don't work, and you see the despair. And actually, I don't just mean sort of the rural redoubts. In Massachusetts, white male life expectancy is falling. In Massachusetts, a liberal state where white men are dying of despair, basically. And the right doesn't talk about anything that matters. And that's how, if you want more Trump, this is the way to get Trump. Trump got the nomination because he was talking about, whatever you feel about Trump, he was talking about stuff that people wanted to talk about. And Jeb and Lindsey Graham, Jeb with his illegal immigration is an act of love, and Lindsey Graham wanting to put boots on the ground in Chad or wherever the hell he wanted to put him, and Marco Rubio talking about a second American century. None of this mumbo jumbo meant anything to people who have the misfortune to live in the parts of America that no longer work. Robert Fox says, after reading the statement issued by the high school student who's being singled out, here is basically a thumbnail view of the timeline surrounding the incident as I see it. And Robert goes to explain that, you know, the high school students had gone there to support the pro-life. They assembled at the Lincoln Memorial, this wacky hate group, black Hebrew Israelites, started calling them a bunch of words you can't say on a family show. Midway through this hour of these 2 hours of obnoxious insults, this so-called tribal elder shows up, and they behave throughout it all. People are saying now that these students, you know, they could have behaved better. They couldn't be, you know, they're students, and a bunch of guys start calling them the most disgusting insult. They don't return it. They sing their school chants. Then some guy turns up and starts drumming in their face. And by the way, Native American drumming, let me just be clear about this, is lousy drumming. You would not want to hit the standard for being a tribal elder drummer is extremely low. It's not good drumming. I know from drumming. You would not want to hear this guy playing with the Benny Goodman Orchestra. This guy can't drum. That's it. So it's annoying. You know, Nobody wants to hear drumming like that. Nobody wants to hear drumming like that. What did I say yesterday? It's not exactly Buddy Rich. It's not, you could pick. I would rather have. I'm not big into the big, the rock drumming. I'm not big into the rock drumming. But I'll tell you something, rock drumming is better than this guy's drumming. So don't give me that. There's no reason to respect Native American drumming because 95% of it is lousy drumming. Now, it may be I don't know. I wasn't here half a millennium ago. And it may have been different. You get to Plymouth Rock and there's nothing going on. There's no cable. They didn't even have basic cable at Plymouth Rock. So maybe when they're sitting around at Plymouth Rock and in the background they can hear Native American drumming, it's like early, it might be like early radio. If you don't have a TV, the Native American drumming in the background of an evening might be very pleasant. But anyway, these guys came and these boys behaved. They were a credit to the school that wants to expel them, is what I said yesterday. And now people say, well, you know, they might have behaved, if they might have done that, they might have shown more respect. Why should you show respect to a guy who comes up and starts drumming in your face? Why? Serious people, Hollywood celebrities, Hollywood directors, want to kill that boy because they don't like his facial expression. And you know, this is where identity politics leads. Because this isn't a boy. There's people with the blue check marks on Twitter, the celebrity crowd with the blue check marks who've been verified. So people know that they're big shot editors or they're producers or they're actresses or whatever. And these guys, you never heard of them. You never been to their town. You're never going to be anywhere near their town. You have no idea of their lives. But you want to, they claim to recognize in this guy's facial expression. And by the way, we should have some kind of societal consensus on what facial expression is appropriate when some guy's drumming under your nose uninvited for 20 minutes. Drumming badly. Under your nose for 20 minutes. What is the appropriate facial expression? Well, this guy got the facial expression wrong. He's a teenager, so they all want to kill him. His life's over. They should just kill him. He's everything. He represents everything that everybody hates. He represents white privilege. Brandy Edwards writes, thank you for your comments on Tucker last night. You were so right about us being in the how did we get there from here phase of society. I wonder if we got here where people are so dehumanized as a result of our technology, social media, entertainment culture. Hollywood TV, video games, etc. have been dehumanizing people for decades now. The news media has jumped on that bandwagon too since they've gone full-blown Democratic Party propaganda machine. Social media has replaced real human interaction. It also really bothers me, though, when they start picking on kids. Kids should be off limits, full stop. I'd say threatening to kill 14 and 15-year-olds is the epitome of bullying, but what do I know? You would think that there would be some criminal liability for these people threatening and doxing these kids. The other thing that strikes me is how the black Hebrew Israelites have gotten a total free pass in the media. Their behavior was threatening and completely abhorrent, yet these guys skate. One last thing. Funny that you mentioned Orwell's 1984 on Tucker last night. I've never read it, and I keep forgetting to ask you if you do that one for Tales of Our Time. Well, I might, but what's incredible to me is how literally we are in a combination of Orwell and Aldous Huxley. Orwell's thing was totalitarianism, was picture a boot stamping on a human face forever. And it's actually subtler than that, because we live in a sensual world, the Aldous Huxley world, where we're sated by our little gizmos on which we find sensual pleasures, like the latest pop song or the latest viral video. And you talk about all the technology. What's happened is that the nature of the technology has changed over the course of the last 100 years. The mass media that was invented at the beginning of the 20th century, if you look at motion pictures and radio, they were communal acts. You bought a ticket and you went to a big picture palace and you gathered in the dark together to watch the movie. Radio was like that until TV came along in the 50s. Radio was something families gathered around in the evening to listen to sitcoms or the Bing Crosby show or whatever, until the 1950s, all that stuff moved to TV and radio became a jukebox. But what happened to radio in a sense was that it was, instead of something that the family did gathering around, sitting in the evening listening to the quiz show or whatever, and it became just sort of targeted to one person taking his transistor radio around. That whole process is accelerated. The people who invented the mobile telephone 4 decades ago, for example, if you had said to them, people, what this will do is it will make people stop talking on the telephone, and instead they will turn the telephone into a typewriter and communicate that way. The people who invented the mobile telephone would have said, that's nuts. Kids aren't going to... Have you ever seen Bye Bye Birdie, the telephone hour, all the teenagers on the phone to each other? Yeah, half a century ago. Now they've turned the telephone into a typewriter for texting. And so these things are actually isolating. So that even when people meet people, they go to places where you used to meet people, coffee shops. And this is in the undocumented Mark Stein, when we talk about, you know, coffee shops in Paris or in 18th century London. The coffee shops were the kind of prototype stock market because people would talk. Now they don't. You go and you see people just looking down, not meeting the gaze, not actually literally not seeing the other, It's very, and this is what's happening where I talked about this when I was guest hosting Tucker a few weeks ago. I think we're actually starting to, in this social isolation, there's never been actually a more Orwellian term, by the way, than social media, which is actually anti-social media. That's what it is. It's not just socially isolating for you, but for the person who happens to attract the attention of social media, like the guy at this school. Social media is where everybody gets together to decide who they're going to club to death today. Social media itself is an Orwellian term. Michael Johnson writes, yet I haven't partaken yet of the live format. Well, we are glad to have you partaking. You're welcome to partake anytime, Michael. That's a good word. You don't have people when they text, they don't use words like partaking, but Michael Johnston uses the word partaking, and I like that. I understand your main subject being the despicable treatment of these patient Catholic kids. It seems self-evident, though, the might must be heard. However, I wonder if you'll have a moment to examine now or soon the Trudeau government's new fascist impaired driving laws. Guilty until proven innocent, and in a foot in the door of everyone's home up to 2 hours after you are alleged to have driven. It seems to me the larger issues are discarding probable cause and unlawful detainment before they threw in guilty until proven innocent to boot. Since you can't prove a negative, we are at the mercy of the state's officials' whims. Yeah, you're absolutely right on that, Michael. The Mr. Trudeau's ministry is actually doing away with things like probable cause. But again, this gets to the agreed narrative. Who do you hate? Who do we all agree to hate? And if you were to go on the CBC and talk about this, you know, then you'd be up against some spokesperson for Mothers Against Drunk Driving or whatever. We live in an age of totalitarian sentimentalism, and that totalitarian sentimentalism is actually stripping away a lot of our liberties. And while we're talking about driving, I'll just add this, that the most fundamental liberty, in a way, because I was very interested. This must be 20 years ago now, when they first started putting OnStar into cars. Do you remember that thing? I think they used to use Batman in the Batmobile to advertise it. And when they introduced OnStar with these Batman ads, a lot of people thought it was terribly cool because your car, OnStar, knows where you are at any time. And I didn't like the idea of this, not just because I have embarrassing personal habits. So if you know, happen to come out at 2 a.m. and say, hello, OnStar, I'm afraid my battery seems to have died. And they say, yes, we can see on the map that you're in the parking lot of Madame Fifi's bondage dungeon, and just hang around there and we'll send someone. Because they know where you are. That's the whole thing about OnStar. Nowhere. Now we have a thing where basically every single telephone is an ankle bracelet. It tells where you are. We're under supervision. And they say, well, you can turn it off if you go in and you don't put this on and you don't use that and you remember to do. If you do use that, if you remember to deactivate this after you finish doing that, then it won't track where you are 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And most people never turn off any of that stuff. So actually, the same people we moan about, the Google, the YouTubes, all these people, know where you are. You're not just giving them control of the internet. You're giving them actual knowledge about where you are anywhere on the planet 24 hours a day. That's what I mean. This is how we get from a land of liberty to a land of technological dictatorship. Lowell Walker says, I was very disappointed when National Review jumped on these kids. They're running an apology today. Mark's right. This will live on forever. Also very disappointed when National Review dropped Mark. I really look forward to what he had to say. You know, I don't want to beat up on National Review. They're comfortable where they are. And people should have the right to take any place on the political spectrum they want to be. Not everybody wants to be 100% right-wing or 100% left-wing. They want to, where they are on that spectrum, and there's a lot of truth in the old Reagan line that you don't make your 80% ally your 20% enemy. There's spots on the spectrum where you can be more or less comfortable. But the methods, it's not even about the policies now, it's not even about the ideology, it's about the methods. And it's nothing, this is evil, what we're doing. Every morning we wake up and social media are in a frenzy over what happens to be the frenzy of the hour. And on Twitter, which is an essentially worthless medium, the object on Twitter is basically to destroy somebody totally. So that, for example, you make one tweet. I mean, Roseanne is the great example of this. Roseanne does one tweet. And it's not just that kills her current sitcom. It kills her entire back catalogue too. I mean, this, as I said to Tucker, the cure is worse than the disease. And what you want is people who understand that. I mean, it's not just that National Review joined in with this. It's that National Review doesn't, their motto in the 1950s was that they would stand athwart history yelling stop. And they don't do that. The American right, the respectable right, Conservative Inc., the Republican Party in Congress, basically stands athwart history yelling, oh, hey, Democrat Party, we'll be catching up to you in about 20 minutes' time. So figure out where the Democrats are on any issue, and the Republicans will be there 18 months later or whatever it is. And that isn't enough. That's why the Democrats win everything that matters, and Paul Ryan gets a corporate tax cut. You know, they never talk about anything that matters. That's why I think they're two of the most useless phenomena on the planet, Congressional Republicans and Conservative Inc. They never talk about anything that matters. Where everything is changing. Everything is changing at extraordinary speed. Now, you go back 10 years, 15 years, before Facebook, before Twitter. The great thing about the internet then was it was all decentralized. People had to link one to another. You know, it was all mom and pop shingles on the internet. And one mom and pop store had to link to another mom and pop store. In order to go viral, you needed the consensus of a bazillion mom and pop shingles on the internet. And now it's the Google algorithm that determines what goes viral or not. Where do you think that's going to be in 5 or 10 years' time? Where do you think that's going to be? For God's sake, why don't the American right, why don't Beltway Inc., why don't Conservative Inc., why don't they talk about anything that matters? It's so bloody boring, the shriveled, reductive vision of conservative. Everything is changing. Everything is changing. We're now at the point where And the left get caught in this too. I've talked about this before. The vagina monologues is unperformable now because the idea that a vagina and womanhood are somehow connected has been overturned on every American campus. So that there are all kinds of women. Some women have vaginas, some women have penises. That's a huge victory. And you think Paul Ryan's stupid, bloody, pathetic, pitiful little tax cut that most people won't... You know, when you've got one party that is abolishing borders, is abolishing citizenship, is abolishing the sexes, and you've got another party that's interested in cheap labour and a reduction in the corporate tax rate, who do you think's going to win anything that matters? That's the dimwit American right for you. The respectable right waste their time talking about everything that matters. Sam Williamson writes, cyber jackals. That's a pretty good term to describe the current state of public discourse in Western civilization. People addicted to their devices living by nanosecond judgments. The barbarians aren't at the gate anymore. They roam freely in people's heads. Shame on conservatives for buying into that snake oil business. You're right, Sam. And I want to emphasize a point I made on Rush. The underbussing, to use the great Kathy Shadle's term, for what happened to Steve King, the Republican congressman in Iowa, who made the mistake of giving an interview to the New York Times. And that was a mistake because it's not a good faith interview. They're doing it to try and get you. They're going to talk to you for 4 hours. And at 3:57, you'll be tired and you'll phrase one thing a little infelicitously and they will seize on that and destroy you. And the last thing the right should be doing, like the congressional leadership in Washington, is going along with that game. Because, as I said, this instant destruction, one quote and you're dead, is actually evil. But it was even worse than that with the Steve King thing, because he was actually talking about Western civilization. He said, Western civilization, when did that become something that you couldn't defend? And instantly, the squishes, the jelly-spined invertebrates of the Republican Party all rush to distance themselves. They're not just distancing themselves from Steve King, but when you actually... The whole purpose of what's going on is to make people afraid so they don't venture out into the public space. Somebody said yesterday... In the comments section, these kids were lucky, you know, when you find yourself in the wrong place at the wrong time. And Laura Rosen Cohen responded that the left's objective is to make everywhere the wrong place at the wrong time for those who disagree with them. So you think about this, the result of these students, these kids, they're teenagers in MAGA hats. So they like Trump. But do you think they like National Review? Do you think they like Ross Dow that, so-called House Conservative at the New York Times? The House Conservative at the New York Times, whose way of backing off the fact that the media got it wrong was to do a plague on both their houses thing, saying that, it's wrong to threaten to dox and kill people, but it's wrong to wear a MAGA hat to a pro-life rally. Really? So these things are equivalent, are they? That headgear is equivalent to actually wanting someone to die? Do you think those guys will ever be Ross Douthat readers? Do you think they'll ever be National Review readers? Do you think they'll ever be Bill Kristol readers? Why? Why? You know, this there is a tragic element to this. There is a tragic element to this. These are young guys. You know, the right has largely lost the young. Not totally, but basically the default setting of everyone under 40 is liberal to one degree or another. Just because they've spent 15 years from kindergarten to whenever they finish the useless degree in grievance studies, accepting that, you know, worrying about climate change is the default setting of society. So we shouldn't be surprised that when you surrender all that ground, people's default setting is liberal. When people actually go to the trouble of seeking out an alternative, and instead they get beaten up by National Review and Bill Kristol and Ross Douthat, I mean, why would anyone actually, why would you, if you're a young person, you think, well, I think climate change is a lot of rubbish and I don't want to do this and I don't want to do that and I don't agree with this. But on the other hand, I don't want to be. Why would I become a conservative? Just get beaten up by Bill Kristol and National Review. I mean, it's a terrible business. It's terrible what they did to those. Lawrence Beasley says, Mark, do you know of any good reason, concerns over accuracy or charity or even just strategy, why we shouldn't call out the conservative establishment for being a controlled opposition? Ace of Spades point out that the leftist media, routinely smears the conservative populace, and the conservative elite still assumes good faith for the former while jumping to the worst conclusions about the latter. If their instinct is take the other side in any fight, maybe we should conclude that they prefer the other side. Well, I think, in fairness, Lawrence, that many of them, it's a class thing. Apart from anything else, many of them, if you look at the life you live, if you're at a beltway think tank, compared to the way some guy does in a broken down mill town in northern New Hampshire or whatever, there is actually not a lot of connective shared experience between those two people, those two persons. The point I made in 2016, it's a lot easier for the base to get itself a new elite than it is for the elite to get itself a new base, still applies. And you see that in Europe. You saw it with Brexit. Basically, with Brexit, as we've seen in what's happened since, with Brexit, all political parties officially, all political parties were opposed to leaving the European Union. And it's been that way for years. The one party that was opposed was UKIP, which is a tiny, parliamentarily irrelevant party, Nigel Farage. And Nigel said to me, we were joking about this backstage a couple of years ago. Nigel Farage said to me, I said, well, is there no other party that's against the European Union? He said to me, Sinn Féin used to be, i.e. the IRA, right? And I think it's Nigel's brother was a British Army officer. So he found himself sharing a stage once with a lady from Sinn Féin, the IRA lady, because They were the only two parties that were opposed to Brexit. And then Sinn Féin were getting so much of the big euro money, they crossed over to become patsies for the European Union. Some bloody nationalist movement that is. They're just arguing about which particular province of the European Union they want to be a part of. That's pathetic. But there was no political party represented the views of half the British people. That's extraordinary. And you see that then in Europe, where it's the same situation, and they've gradually turned to other parties. And those parties have been elected to power in very stable, in politically stable societies, like Austria. Ever since the unpleasantness with Herr Hitler, Austria has had a left-of-centre party and a very mildly right-of-centre party, and regardless of who you voted for, they always governed in the same left-of-centre, mildly right-of-centre coalition for half a century. Until then, these new populists and nationalists and all the rest of it came to power. And Claire Belinsky has a very interesting piece in the American Interest. And she's talking about how none of the people who are complaining on the streets of France, the gilets jaunes, the yellow jackets, nothing they say makes any sense. And she begins by saying, and it's interesting to me, for example, she starts with this thing. She says, the problem in Western societies is people are upset about things. And there are many theories about what it is they're upset about. And Claire Belinsky writes, the most popular involve wage stagnation, inequality, globalization, capitalism, the digitalization of the economy, social media, immigration, the disappearance of traditional venues for social life, the transformation of gender roles, the decline of religion. And she tries to say none of this makes any sense because on any measure, life in France is better than it's ever been. And she starts to talk about the measures. She says, France is one of the world's wealthiest countries. That's true. That's true. But it doesn't matter if a country is wealthy. What matters is how you live. The wealth of a country is slightly irrelevant. There are lots of happy people in quite poor countries. France's economy is the seventh largest. Only three other countries have more companies in the global 500 top companies. Of the world's very wealthy countries, it has the most generous welfare system, the shortest working week, the earliest retirement, the best healthcare system. France's per capita GDP last year was at an all-time high. Purchasing power is at an all-time high. And she goes on with all these economic statistics that are all irrelevant. What people in France feel, what people in Britain feel, what people in the United States feel, in the non-functioning parts of the United States, is that their society is transforming into something unrecognizable, and they do not even have the consolations of culture. Everyone knows about a kind of cultural isolation. Mostly it's generational. So that if you were young at the beginning of the 20th century and you like Casey would waltz with the strawberry blonde and the band playing on. If that was your idea of a pop song and you live to 90 years old and it's all and every time you go into a department store they're playing gangster rap or hip hop or whatever it is, you're culturally dislocated. And that's what cultural dislocation used to mean. It was generational. That it was no longer waltzes and parlor ballads. You got old and suddenly it was swing and rhythm and blues. And then it became rock and roll. And then it became punk and heavy metal. And it's given you an incredible... And that was what cultural dislocation was. It was just generational. But they were still recognizably the same people living in the same, rooted in the same soil that you had always lived in. Now, in our societies, cultural dislocation is way beyond that. It's like, it's the sense that everything is being transformed. It's the sense that, and the so-called conservatives are not actually in the conservative business because they're not actually interested in seriously conserving anything. Emily Maximiv says, the Covington School incident is a good reminder about the dangers of identity politics. The number of people willing to wall themselves off in identity politics seems to be growing and only reaffirms my belief we are headed back to living in a segregated society. Segregation in the name of diversity is already occurring on American campuses with racially segregated dorms and even segregated graduation ceremonies. That's true, actually. That's incredible. Universities are segregating. I was looking a few months back at Leonard Bernstein at Harvard. And, you know, he was a great American theater composer. And I remember thinking, Harvard, isn't that the place where they have, what is it they call it? The Hasty Pudding Club? The amateur theatricals by the young varsity chappies at Harvard? I wonder what Leonard Bernstein was. Well, he couldn't get into the Hasty Pudding Club because he was Jewish. And the Hasty Pudding Club at that time didn't accept Jews. So even though he's like a great American man of the theatre, he never did any theatre at Harvard because he was a Jew. So you think about this, and decades go by, and I think at the end of his life he was made an honorary member of the Hasty Pudding Club or something like that. Because at that point, we thought that everybody should be doing everything together. And the way you go to university is like you grow up in some hick small town and you mix with people who are like you from your particular corner of the world, small town. You go to university and you meet people who are different. They come from everywhere. They come from all over the planet. And that's the point of going to university. Except now they say, oh, no, wait a minute. We're going to have a graduation ceremony that's just for African Americans. But what's interesting too, Emily, is it's not just it's actually a hierarchical segregation, as explicitly hierarchical as apartheid or anything else. And the right, this is what was so revealing about what happened over the weekend, is that at heart, the chaps at National Review watched that video and accepted implicitly, subconsciously, the hierarchy of the right. That if you see some teenager from a private Catholic school and an Indian tribal elder, so-called, that you're supposed to be on the side of the tribal elder. And this is the danger here. The hierarchy of identity politics is quite explicit now. I mean, I think it's quite amusing, if you don't have a dog in the fight, that the transgender crowd beat feminism, for example. So nobody cares, as mentioned, nobody cares about the vagina monologues. As I think I said on the Mark Stein cruise, there's a small group of feminists and lesbians in particular who don't like the transgender movement because they think it's an attempt to reimpose the phallocracy by the back door, as it were. And so the idea that a woman is walking around hung like a stallion and she's showering in the showers at the health club with the old meat and two veg swinging around there and everybody's just got to pretend that she's a woman like any other woman, they understand that something in that is not good for feminism, if not good for feminism. And that what is happening in women's sports, where essentially people who were born men are now taking them over, is actually going to happen to the feminist movement in general. And that once you accept that you can have a penis and be a woman, that something in there is not going to work out well for feminism. And what's interesting is they can't find a way of arguing it in terms of identity politics. The point about identity politics is to destroy language. So you can't even find the words to argue your corner. So that when, for example, the phrase her penis becomes acceptable, then literally language has been so transformed you can't even argue that corner. But what was and we all know who's at the top of the hierarchical pole, Islam. Because Islam, when it's confronted by a woman with a penis, throws the woman with a penis off the roof of the building or sets the woman with a penis alight. They're old school on that. They don't want to have a debate. They'd just as soon kill you. So everyone's slightly wary of Islam. So we see that, you know, transgender trumps feminism, Muslim trumps gay. The hierarchies of identity politics are beginning to emerge. This is evil. We are... The great thing about common law... I love common law, and common law has been perverted, particularly by statute law generally, but particularly in the United States. But what I always loved about common law was that there was just you. There were people equal before the law. That was the point about it. It didn't really deal in identity groups as such. And now we have identity groups and we have the hierarchy of identity groups. And what was so bloody stupid about National Review over the weekend is they walked brain dead into accepting essentially the not just identity politics, but the left's hierarchy of identity politics. Pathetic and embarrassing. Jamie Marsh says, Mark, unfortunately, we've come to expect a social media lynch mob from the left. It's still shocking to see the ugliness in action, but when did we lose the pseudo-right? What you so appropriately call conservatism, Inc. Trump wasn't originally my first choice, but that didn't cause me to lose my mind because he won. And he's done a fair job, I think. How could Conservatism, Inc. get it so wrong that they seem to sell out their core values? Is it just raw hatred is making them crazy, or were they phonies from the start? Well, I think I think some of them take their philosophy seriously, you know, for whatever that is worth. You have to be able to afford to take philosophy seriously. For example, you might philosophically be in favour of private healthcare with no government distortion of the market. But if you happen to be shingling your roof and you fall off and you land on the ground and you don't have health insurance, your view of healthcare provision in civilised societies is informed less by your philosophical view of the role of government in healthcare provision than by the fact that you're lying on the ground with a broken back and you don't have health insurance. And the gap between the conservative philosophers and the reality of life lived in America today widened. And it wasn't just that Trump won. It's that all the other guys lost. I believe, and I still believe, that nobody else would have beaten Hillary, because everybody else would have been trying to put together that big L shape down the Rockies and then out east through the South to the Atlantic that enabled, with New Hampshire's 4 electoral votes, George W. Bush to limp across the finish line in 2000. And that's what all these guys like Karl Rove are about, trying to hold that L, even as demographic changes are nibbling away at the L. So by the time of whatever it was, Romney in 2012, it looked like some Cuban heel that's all been sort of half fallen off. You couldn't do that. Marco Rubio couldn't have done that. You had to have someone, Ted Cruz couldn't have done that. Jeb Bush couldn't have done that. They would all have lost, and they would have lost because they couldn't withstand the battering they would have got from the media, because they would have been like Mitt Romney. They would have been like milquetoast guys who were turned into evildoers because that's just what the media does. That's just what the media does. Macedonian content farmer. I hope this is the same. On the Mark Steyn cruise, by the way, I met... I don't want to give the name away in case it's not the same Macedonian content farmer, but we had some Mark Steyn cruisers who gave me a rather nice Macedonian content farmer T-shirt in the actual Macedonian language. So I hope this is the same Macedonian content farmer who says there have been many Road to Dystopia remakes, e.g. Wells's Morlocks Breeding Eloy, Huxley's Drug-Induced Brave New World, Orwell's Strongman, Heinlein's American Theocracy, etc. The latter may actually be happening in Europe, but it won't even be pseudo-Christian. What I see happening here is more akin to Zardosh, where the smart swells wall themselves off from the brutish world. Unfortunately, I don't think that such people realise that they are, in fact, the Golga Frinchen telephone sanitizers, and it is they who would go extinct. This sort of thinking was hinted at by a rare bit of inventive comedy on Saturday Night Live, where they showed a parody commercial for The Bubble, a walled-off version of Brooklyn, where you only had like-minded left-wing people around you. And do the established members of Conservatism Inc. loathe themselves, or are they in it to get to the good cocktail parties? Inquiring minds want to go. Everybody talk. The only time you ever hear about cocktail parties is in relation to the rhino sellout of the Beltway. But you make an interesting point, Mr. Content Farmer. And I think the interesting thing is that the whole bubble, the idea of a And that's a particularly American idea. As I always say, the American dream is really nothing about except socioeconomic mobility, that where you end in life is not determined by where you start. We have declining social mobility in America today, to the point where on some measures it's less than Scandinavia, of course, because Scandinavia, there aren't a lot of very rich people, there aren't a lot of very poor people. Everyone's sort of kind of in the middle. But it's also less than the United Kingdom, which is strange because on certain indicators, in the UK, it's easier to get from my old man's a dustman and you're living in your council flat, to get from the council flat to Downton Abbey, than it is to get from one of the broken loser parts of America to McLean, Virginia, for example. Never mind Malibu or wherever. And this is... And what's interesting now is that this would previously have been regarded as a problem. And now all the clever people in America take it as written. All the guys, the Facebook guy and the Google guys, that this is the way it is. There's never going to be a middle class again because there's no jobs for them to do. The mills are gone, the factories are gone, there's the cubicle jobs. But the cubicle jobs are all going. Being a travel agent, working in a travel agency used to be a nice job, but they've all gone now. People do it themselves online. What's left? Well, there's fast food shifts. But again, that's all being automated. There'll be nothing for anyone to do. There'll be a very an elite who live rewarding, productive lives on top. And there will be this great seething mass below. And you will have to have big government to keep them from getting restless. And you will have to have whatever the mid-21st century version of an iPhone is. It will have to have more sensory and 3D and virtual reality experiences, because they will need ever more sophisticated distractions to keep them anesthetized from rising up against the swells, as Macedonian content farmer puts it, walled off. And that's what I mean. We're really in a dangerous stage here. A dangerous stage. And what happened over the weekend was actually a staged entertainment. It's interesting, a tweet or a video clip, and suddenly it's a story in the Washington Post, New York Times, which don't really exist anymore. They're not things. You don't see people reading the Washington Post while they're strap hanging on the subway. That's not a thing anymore. But they exist to give the imprimatur of respectability to a tweet or a Facebook clip. And suddenly the cyberjackals are feasting on some guy, some nobody. But he is literally the Orwellian two-minute hate. And we hate him. We hate it for 24 hours. He's torn apart. And then tomorrow it'll be somebody else. And it is not going to be a pleasant world, this world. The problems here is we've got three institutions, maybe, you know, Google, YouTube, Facebook, Amazon, who will control all knowledge on the planet. And they will, they're far bigger than John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil 110 years ago. And they will work as a cartel, and they will work as a global cartel. So eventually there will be nowhere on the planet to go to escape them. They will control all knowledge. And when people get antsy and people will get restless, then there will be like some kid from some school you've never heard of who'll be glimpsed on a screen, and he'll have the wrong expression when he's sitting through the transgender graduation ceremony at Harvard or wherever it is. And so he'll be torn apart, and he'll be finished, and he'll be erased, and he'll be vaporized. And that will serve two functions. It will get rid of anyone awkward, but it will persuade millions and millions of other people just to increasingly become cowed and subservient. And they'll just, you know, just post their cat videos, as long as it's not like that poor chap in Scotland where he trained his cat to do Heil Hitler salutes, because then even the cat video will end your career. And this world, this new world, this world without borders, world without citizenship, world without the sexes, so that even something as basic as a birth certificate is actually mumbo-jumbo now. And any dissent to these profound transformations is only licensed and ever more narrowly by three companies around the planet. And you think there's going to be a place for the Weekly Standard or National Review in that world? The Beltway Conservatives will be torn apart. Jay Nordlinger's thing is what it was a perfect example of what happens when you kiss up to these guys. He said, oh, you know, it's an American disgrace, those awful, ghastly schoolboys confronting that dignified old Indian. And immediately everyone tears him apart for saying old Indian. There's not going to be any place for you in that world. So you can either set about, you know, my God, instead of standing athwart history going, me too, I know I'm a bit late to the party, but me too. Why don't you actually think about where we're headed and the speed at which we're going there and figure out what to do about it? Instead of kissing up to the people, you know, they talk about, oh, no, no money for walls, no money for walls, no money for walls. Three organizations that control the entirety of human knowledge across the planet, and they're building walls for you. They're building a wall around you right now, even as we speak. And they have no trouble getting funding for that wall, and it's not a wall of steel slats that they can see through. It's a wall that will close you off and imprison you. And that totalitarian future is being built for us right now. I've gone on a little too long, and I didn't mean to go on too long. But we will do it again next time. We've had tons of good questions, and I got a bit carried away. So we will pick up some of your questions and do it in one of our special video editions of Mark's Mailbox in a couple of days' time. And I think, who was it? Somebody said, did I get to that question? Somebody said they were coming from Virginia to see me in Pennsylvania or wherever. If you're, don't forget, me and Dennis Miller in Pennsylvania, New York. It starts in Reading, Pennsylvania, then Syracuse and Rochester, New York. And let's have some. I don't like it if I can't do my Marquess Dufferin gags for Dr. Roy. So I'd like a good Ontario turnout for the Syracuse and Rochester gigs. And then this nightmare pronunciation pit of despair and doom. I'm not even going to. It starts with Wilkes, and I've had like 57 different pronunciations for how it ends. Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. We will see you. We will see you next time, and do join me on the video edition of Mark's Mailbox. See you next time.